We're going to talk about backtracking, the process of backtracking, writing backtracking code, code that will try to work its way towards a solution, realize that it's wrong, that the solution that it's working towards is incorrect, and will back up to a previous partial solution and try to solve the problem a different way. Okay? This is typically called backtracking code. It does allow you to write programs which have a modicum of intelligence built into them. Now, the problem that we're going to look at, which is sort of the classic backpacker's problem. If you've ever hiked for quite a few miles or whatever, you know that if you want to cover 10 or 20 miles a day, whatever you're going to try and cover each day. If you know that you are on an average day's hike like that, you can carry on your back a certain number of pounds and still cover that distance. You know, that it will differ from person to person. But whatever that arbitrary poundage or whatever you want to weigh it in, kilograms, doesn't matter. But whatever that is, that's some value X. Well, when you're preparing to go on your trip, you will lay out the things that you need to take, want to take. And of course, some things are absolutely necessary, that you have to take them. Food, things like that. Those you weigh out and you sort of subtract from your maximum weight. And those and the rest of the things that you have, aren't absolute essentials. The question is, from these other things that aren't absolute essentials, what do you take and what do you not take is always the question. Now, we're not going to look at the full-blown version of this problem, which is actually quite complicated. The full-blown version of this problem would be that you would, for each of these other items, these non-essential items, you would weigh them out, and you would associate with them their weight in grams or whatever your weighting system is, and you would also associate with them a priority of how desirable it is to you to take that item with you. And then your problem would be to choose a subset of these items which ideally equals the exact weight that you have left that you can carry, and also at the same time maximizes the priority of the items that you choose. And you have to be aware that in attempting to solve a problem like this, that there may not be an optimal solution. There may be no subset of these items that exactly totals up to the weight that you can carry, which means that you have to be prepared on your solution to arrive at a near optimal solution. You have to be able to find a solution that's the closest to the optimal solution. The subset that comes closest to the optimal weight, but also maximizes the priority. And that's a very difficult problem. Now, this is a good little sort of technique to keep in mind in terms of problem solving and attacking very complex problems like this. One of the best pieces of advice that I can give you in trying to tell you how to attack complex problems is to don't tackle complex problems. Now, what that means, a seemingly false advice, whatever, incorrect advice really means, is that you should not try and solve the really complex problem the way it's set up to start with. There may be too many things in the problem for you to deal with to arrive at a solution. or to arrive at a solution in a reasonable amount of time. And so what you do is you use the problem solution technique that we've really been teaching you all along, that you've made use of all along in your programming. You just sort of apply it differently, and that is you only deal with a small amount of things to begin with. And so what you do is you take the problem and you throw out parts of the problem. You throw them out. Like for the knapsack problem that I just described. Let's forget the priority ordering. I'm going to toss that. I'm not going to worry about the priority order. Now my problem reduces to I've got a set of items that are weighted, and I'm trying to find a subset that either exactly equals this value that I can carry or comes closest to it, right? Okay. I'm going to simplify it further. I'm not going to bother to try and find the ordering that comes closest to it. I'm going to first just try and see if I can solve the simpler form of the problem, which is there just a subset of these items that exactly equals the weight that I can carry? So I'm not going to worry sort of about the inequality restriction. And I'm going to simplify it a little bit further. In reality, I would need to know, if you think about it, if I do find a subset, I would need to know which elements in my subset adds up to that, to the weight that I can carry. I'm not going to worry about that. I'm not going to worry about identifying them. I'm going to just worry about whether some subset exists. There also might be the problem that more than one subset might exist. There might be more than one solution to this problem. I'm not going to worry about that. I'll just see if I can find a solution. So I just keep simplifying the problem down until I get it to its bare necessities. Like, okay, for the items that I would have laid out, I would probably have a name for each item or, as to what they are. I'm not going to worry about that. Who cares? I'll just worry about the weights, the numbers. Some of the weights might be, like a fraction. No, I'm not going to worry about that. I'm not going to deal with fractions. I'm going to make them all integers. Maybe even weighing them out in kilograms, where I have something that might be 0.5 kilograms, I'll just do it all in grams, okay? And I won't bother to break up grams. So now all I have to deal with is integers. So now my problem has reduced to the following. I've got an array of integers, which represents weights of items. And I've got a value that represents some total weight that I can carry. And I just want to try and write a program or a function that will take that array and that total and tells me whether or not some subset of items in the array will sum up to this total. And that's the problem I'm going to try and solve. Once I've solved that, then I can go back and add in these other little features one at a time and expand upon this very basic solution. Now that's really one of the best techniques that I can give you for problem solving, is that don't necessarily, when you get a very difficult problem, try and solve it by working on the entire problem all at once. Okay? Simplify it. I went to a discussion yesterday, a talk that Dr. Watson gave, which was a very interesting talk, where he was talking about how you take complex problems. This was really very, very difficult. He was talking about taking complex problems and in Euclidean dimensional space, solving manifold vector problems, whatever you want to call them. And rather than simplifying them, he actually made them more complex. He made them more complex, and he did like a couple transpositions until he could recapture the problem into another system as a more complex problem, but into another system in which he has more tools to work with. And he could solve the more complex problem, and then by sort of backward transposition, he arrives at a solution to his original problem, which is in a system that he doesn't have very many tools to work with. That was pretty ingenious. And I don't know who the first guy he said was some guy at the University of Wisconsin, some mathematician, Manzarian or something, who sort of hit upon this sort of idea. And it's not an idea that most people or most mathematicians would ever think about. Okay, let's take this really complex problem that we can't solve and make it more complex. I don't know how he hit upon that idea, but that, to me, that gives you everything else I've ever learned in mathematics. I mean, you always sort of learn to recount it in simpler terms. Before you try and learn things like that, try and learn this approach. Okay? Now, for the NatSat problem, we're going to solve this recursively, and then a little bit later on, we'll look at an iterative solution. We'll look at an iterative solution later on in the notes, and we'll come back and compare the two. This is one of the classic problems where solving it recursively, if you can understand it and hit upon the right attack method, you can solve it trivially using a recursive solution. Iteratively, it's a dog to solve. It is a bear to try and solve this thing iteratively. And this is where the real power of recursion comes in. So what we'll do here on slide 917, if we're going to solve things recursively, we have to somehow come up with the simplest, very, very simplest forms of our problem that we automatically know the solution for. Well, we're given an integer total and an array, and we want to determine if some subset of those array elements sums up to that total. Now, one thing you should also not get into a habit of doing is think, when you have a problem sort of stated like this, don't think that that's the only thing you can use, the only pieces of information that you can use to pass around to solve the problem. You can pass around other things. You can pass around information that you yourself decide to pass around to help you solve it. One of the things that we can pass around here that will help us solve it will be the indices, the starting and ending position, subscripts of the array. All right, so we have a start position, we have an end position, or a stop position. I forget what I called it. Yeah, an end position. So, our special base cases, the various trivial, simplest forms. Now, the first one is really kind of tough to come up with, because you almost think no one would ever try and ask you to solve it, because it's too trivial. What if our total was equal to zero? If somebody asked us to come up with a subset of the array elements that sum up to zero, see, it's one you almost don't think of, because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to try and solve that, because the solution is the empty set, none of them. So there is a solution though, right? There is a solution. But that actually is going to be important because of the way we're going to be solving this recursively. The other one is, what if they ask us to sum up, find a sum for a negative number? Well, there is no way we can have weights of things that add up to a negative number, okay? Unless we get into some weird Heinleinian extra-dimensional space, which we weren't going to talk about, okay? We won't worry about that. Heinlein was a great writer until he discovered that crap. And there is a solution for that. The solution is that there is no collection that sums up to a negative number. There is no collection of positive integers that sum up to a negative integer, okay? And the other one then, the other sort of trivial solution is, what if they ask us to sum up for a subset of the array that doesn't exist? where the start position that they give us in the array is greater than the end position. If they ask us that, there's no such collection that can exist. So those are our base cases. Alright? Those are our base cases. Now, think about this. You've got an array. You've got a list of integer values, and you want to see if this list, and let's say this list is very large. If the list is small and the value is small, you can almost eyeball it and see if there's a solution. The human mind can handle maybe 4 or 5, 7, 8, maybe even 9 or 10. And, you know, if you're Dustin Hoffman and you're actually an idiot, an autistic, then you might be able to handle a lot of others. But most people probably can't handle more than about 5 or 7 numbers and a weight and eyeball it and see if there's some subset that adds up to that. So let's assume that there's a very large number, like 1,000. There's 1,000 items or a couple hundred and a fairly large weight. So let's say you had to solve it yourself. So I've given you maybe on a piece of paper a list of integers, maybe a couple hundred of them, and I've given you a total. And now your job is to see if you can find some subset of those that equal this one. Now, when you try and solve a problem like this, you should think of it like that. Think of having to do it yourself. Don't think of, how do I tell the computer to do it? And that's not the first thing you should be thinking about. Because the computer is pretty stupid. And if you, and the computer is nowhere near as smart as you are, and if you can't solve it yourself, you certainly can't tell this idiot box how to solve it. And that's what you're doing in programming. In programming, you're telling this stupid little machine in very detailed, explicit, step-by-step, excruciatingly pin-headed, anal steps how to do this thing, okay? One of these days, we'll have computers like on Star Trek, and we can go, go out and solve the NetSec problem for me, and don't bore me with the details. Unfortunately, we don't have those. We don't have those things. If you can't solve it yourself, you aren't going to be able to instruct the computer to do it. So before you instruct the computer to do it, come up. You don't actually have to do the work. You just have to come up with a way to where you could eventually solve it. Obviously, for 200 items and a fairly large number, the number of calculations you might have to perform might be rather long, tedious, and time-consuming. But all you have to do is come up with a method. So how would you do that? Any ideas? Huh? Sort it. That might help, but it's not a big help. Wouldn't hurt.
Maybe more. Maybe not.
Maybe make it. Might make it a little bit more efficient, but in the long run, I don't think so. Wouldn't hurt though. It's not a bad guess. Uh huh.
With a whole set, you pick number and start with that first number and then solve the problem for that.
That's essentially correct. Now, it's hard a lot of times to explain things like that to people. I understood him because I know the solution. Okay? Basically, what his idea was, if you've got that long list, you take a look at your first number. And you go, okay, I'm going to assume that the first number is part of a possible solution. If I assume that the first number is part of a possible solution, that would mean then that I could reduce the amount that I have to, my total, by the first number. And then my problem reduces to checking to see if the rest of the numbers sum up to this reduced total, right? And do I have a problem, do I have a solution for that? It's what I'm writing. I can call it recursively and I'm done. Not quite, but close. That is one of the recursive calls. That is one of the recursive calls. And that's the trick to doing, if there is such a thing, as doing things recursively. is realizing when you've reduced your problem slightly, and now you've got the same problem, just reduced slightly, that you just call it recursively. Right? Now you have to think about what happens when you call it recursively. So let's say I've got this function. Let's say this function is a Boolean function, which is what I'm really going to write, especially if you've looked ahead. I'm going to write a Boolean function. So I'm going to call this thing recursively for the total minus the first item, the item in the start position. I'm going to call it recursively for this reduced total, total minus my array sub start. And then I want to see if it sums up to that total for the rest of the positions in the array, which would be start plus 1 to n. Now, when that function, that's a Boolean function. So when that function comes back, I only have to deal with how many values?
2.
2. Thank you. It either comes back being true or false. Now, if it comes back being true, what does it mean? I found a solution. And if I found a solution to this reduced form of the problem, then I know that this first number, hold on a minute, let me get through this discussion. Then I know that this first number, which I assumed would be in the collection, I now know that that is what? A valid assumption, and that it is in the collection. And therefore, I should return true. Now, the other possibility, though, when I make that recursive call for this reduced total and the rest of the array, what if it comes back false? What do I know? That there is no solution for the rest of the array and this reduced total. So what does that tell me? Huh? Move to the next. What do you mean by move to the next element? What does it tell me about my assumption? My assumption was incorrect. So that means that my assumption that the first item was in the collection, in the subset that sums up to the total, that would tell me that assumption that I made about the first item being in the collection that sums up to the total can't be correct. That would mean that if there is a solution, this first item cannot be in the solution. It cannot be part of the solution. It cannot be part of that subset that adds up the total. Now, does that mean that there is still a possible solution?
Yes.
And what's the possible solution? It's that the remaining elements, that there might be a collection of the remaining elements that sum up to what? My original total. And do I have a function to do that? It's the one I'm writing. And now I'm done. There's nothing else to deal with. I'm done. It solved it. Question? No, I'm not making that assumption at all. They might enter an integer that's exactly equal to one of the elements. They might be entering an integer that's less than all of the elements. They might be entering an integer that's equal to a few of the elements. So I'm not making any assumption about that whatsoever. Now, I can share. That's up to them. That's their version of the problem that they're wanting me to try and solve. This solution will, this method will still work regardless of what number they give me. Okay? You have to think about it, but it does. Now here on the, and here is, that's the backtracking step. That second recursive call is what's known as the backtracking step. See, to start out with, I am reducing the problem by the sum of the first of the start item and checking to see if that one might be part of the solution. And I work my way down doing that, and as I work my way down the array making those assumptions, at some point I'll come back and realize that some of those assumptions might be incorrect or are incorrect. And at that point, I'll have to try an alternate solution, okay, without this item. I'll have to backtrack and undo part of the work that I've done to try and find a solution and arrive at another solution. One of the beauties of this sort of problem-solution technique is that if there is a solution, it will find it. This will methodically try every possible solution. I'm very methodically trying every possible solution. I'm going to try to include each element and then try to exclude each element if I have to try and find a solution. If I do that for every element, I've tried every possible solution. This also is an example of a class of algorithms, a whole group of algorithms that we in computer science term greedy algorithms. They're termed greedy algorithms because they're not really very intelligent. If you think about it, let's say that I scale this problem up. And rather than sort of the backpacking problem, maybe there's some other problem that's much larger, where I've got maybe a million items or several thousand, and I've got a large number that I'd have to check to see if some subset adds up to that. If I start my computer working on that, how long do you think it's going to take it to find a solution on the average? I better not be in any hurry. Even if I've got a screaming Pentium 4, I better not be in any hurry. Because it's going to take it a while. It's going to have to try every possible solution. And for thousands of items, that could take it a long time. Even blazingly as fast as the machines are. There are certain problems that we will find out later. There are certain sizes of this problem, for example, that we couldn't practically use this for. I mean, think about it. If we embedded this kind of code in a program and the user at some point says, oh, okay, I need to use this little part of the program over here to tell me if some subset totals up to this out of these thousands of items. No, we better have some code in our program that brings them up a dialog box going, are you really sure about this? And we better use the voice of Marvin from Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide, where he says, are you sure about this? Because this is going to take me a very long time, even with my astronomically fast brain. Okay? We better warn them. We better warn them that they better rethink this. Because it could take hours and maybe even days in some cases. Greedy algorithms are quite useful, but really only on small to moderate data sets. They do not scale up well to problems with large amounts of data. They don't scale up well at all. And you as a programmer had better know that, because you don't want somebody, you know, coming around later to your program going, 3 days ago I started your program working on this problem and it's still working. Microsoft did not embed this kind of stuff into Microsoft Excel early on. With the early versions of Excel, they didn't do it. I had this person, I was working at another school at that point. I'd met these people, we went to a tour of their research facility, and I met some of them, and we later had dinner or whatever, and about a week later they called me. said, you know, if you don't mind, I've got this problem I'd like to ask you about Excel. And I said, okay, well, what is it? And they went on to explain it to me. You know, I realized the idiots were using Excel for something that wasn't designed to do, and they basically had hit upon a greedy part of the program, and they were complaining because it would take it a day or two to do what they wanted it to do. Well, no wonder it was taking it a day or two to do what you wanted it to do. It wasn't designed to do that quickly. You should have been using it for that. They didn't like that answer. They thought I could somehow just miraculously tell them, you know, some little trick to do to get it to work faster. No, there was no simple solution. So, here's the code for this. And look at this code. Three if statements and a return, and I'm done. I'm done with this terribly difficult problem. Piece of cake. All right, so here's my array. I'll pass it around a constant reference. I'm not going to be changing anything inside of it. That's got my weights in it. Here's the total. Here's my start and my end position. And I'll check. If total is equal to zero, hey, I'm done. There is a collection that adds up to zero. I'm done. Otherwise, if total is negative or start is greater than end, there is no solution. I can return false. Otherwise, I first make the assumption that the start element is in the solution. So I'm going to check. If that's true, if it is in the solution, there has to be a solution to this reduced problem where I reduce the total by the rate of start amount, and I check to see if the remaining elements in the array from start plus 1 sum up to this reduced total. And if that's true, then that means the start element was in the collection, and I'm done. If that's false, then I know that if there is a solution or not a solution, it has to be by excluding this start element. So I just check to see whether or not, true or false, a solution exists for the rest of the array from start plus 1 to end for the original total, basically skipping the first start item. Now, here is a little trace for this very simple little example. I've got a 5-element array, and I want to check to see if that sums up to 100. So I go from 0 to 4. Now, starting out here for that, I would check total's not 0, it's not less than 0, start's not greater than n. I get down here, and I try to include the first element. So that would be ray sub start, total minus 50 is 50. Start plus 1 is 1. So I check to see is there a collection from 1 to 4 that sum up to 50. So I call that recursively. Now I check, okay, total's not 0, it's not less than 0, start's not greater than n, blah, blah. So now I check to see if the first item of this one is included in the set. So start sub array sub start, which is array sub 1, I subtract that from total, that gives me 30. Start plus 1 is 2, and then n. So now I make this recursive call. So I check here, you know, it's not less than 0, it's not equal to 0, start's not greater than n. Come down now and try to see if this one is included. So I say total minus array sub start, which is array sub 2, that's negative 10. And then start plus 1 and end. Well, now when I make this recursive call, total is less than 0, so I return false. I return false back up to this call. Now when I return false back up to this call is finished execution. I'm now back up here continuing with this call. This is false, so I jump down to here. These are my current values for the variables. So now I check to see if there's a total that exists skipping this second one. The total is 30, start plus 1 is 3, and end is 4. So now I start with this recursive call. And I'm going to check to see if the third one is in that one. So I reduce total by rate of start, which is rate of 3 or 60. That's negative 30. And start plus 1 to end, you can see what's going to happen again. It's negative, so that returns false. So I get back up here. Well, this one can't be in there. So I have to jump down and make another recursive call, skipping the third one. So I skip the third one. So that's start or total, start plus wand, end. Now I'm here. Now I'm going to check to see if the start one is included in this subset. So I reduce total minus ray sub start, 30 minus 30, 0. Now I have start plus wand, end. It's important that the first check comes before the second base condition checks. Because when this is 0, I have a solution. Even though I've walked off of the end of the array, I've walked off of it because I found a solution. So since this is 0, that returns true, which causes this one to return true, boom, boom, boom. The advantage of this is that if you, this is sort of a trivial, as I said, a trivial example of the problem, because you could look at 100 and go, yeah, there are two solutions in there that sum up to 100. But could you eyeball the same thing if you had a couple hundred items with a total that was in the thousands? Okay. Question? The order here doesn't matter. The order here makes absolutely no difference. If I have 50, what did you say, 50? Yeah, that'll still work. If you don't believe it, you trace it out, it'll still work. Okay? Trust me, it'll work. The data doesn't matter. Okay? The data here doesn't matter. It's not a solution if it only works for one set of data. Okay? It's not a general solution, it's a specific solution. It would be a solution just for that one set of data, but that's not really a highly useful program, is it? Here, I've written this program, and it'll do your taxes, but only if you have one kid, if you earn $50,000, okay? Never mind. Whoever.
I just want to say that's beautiful.
Isn't it? I think so. Question?
What if there's no solution?
What if there's no solution? It returns false. Okay? It returns false. If the last element wasn't 30, what would the trace look like? If the last element was not 30, then this would not end up being 0. Now, so there are two possibilities. Either it's negative, which means this would return false, which would cause this one to return false, this one would to return false. Would it automatically cause this one to return false? No. What would it cause this one to do? It would then make another recursive call. Okay? The other possibility would that this wouldn't be negative, but it would be positive. If it would be positive, what would this return? False, because start would be greater than end. And so the same thing would happen. False, false, up. Make. Now I have to try and skip the first one. Here I previously tried to, here I tried to include it, right? I reduced it by 20. Here I'd have to try and skip it, so I'd call it recursively with 52 to 4. And it would work its way through all those other possibilities. Okay? Question?
At what magnitude would a...
At what size of a problem would this be reasonable to try and execute? Well, that would be highly dependent upon the processor, obviously. I'd have to do some calculations. I'd have to do some calculations, but it wouldn't be very large. I'd be willing to bet after above about 1,000 items, you get tired sitting there watching your machine just work its little heart out to try and come up with a solution. There are a lot of problems like this. There are a large number of problems whereby the speed that we're going to be gaining for the foreseeable future due to Moore's Law, what does that statement mean? What are the speed increases in computing that we will be seeing over the next, we'll make it simple, 3 years due to Moore's Law? If Moore's Law is exact, and so far it's been pretty close, what does that say in 3 years' time about the time that most of you are getting ready to get the crap out of here and get a real job and earn more money than me. That was a joke. About what time will the students who are entering then, how will the speed of their computers compare to the one that you're getting ready to take away with you, toss on the dump pile, and replace? Theirs will be... Theirs will be about, what did you say? Three times? Four times. I think it would be four. Doesn't Moore's Law say that it doubles about every 18 months, which would be about a year and a half? So 3 years, four times, okay? Doubles every year and a half. There are a lot of problems whereby for any foreseeable future, like the next 10 or 20 years, without some miraculous breakthrough that blows Moore's Law away, to where the computers stop, they start getting a lot faster than just doubling every 18 months, that for the foreseeable future there are a lot of problems that the faster processor speeds aren't going to even affect. Okay? Instead of taking 20 days to solve it, it'll take 18. Okay? There are a lot of problems like that. And that's really sort of the crux of problem solving. There's a lot of people who are attacking a lot of these problems through research and stuff, trying to come up with entirely different, non-greedy solutions, more intelligent solutions. Now, his idea to begin with was sort this thing. That may not be a bad idea. If we sort this, then, you know, maybe we sort it in descending order so that we're subtracting the largest first. Now, would that affect our solution? Yes, it would. If we sorted this thing in descending order to where we were subtracting the largest first, we would be getting closer to zero faster, right? So we would at least increase our chances of arriving at a solution faster. How much of an increase? That's highly dependent upon the data. But that's a minor improvement that we could probably make. However, that improvement does not come without a cost, because sorting is expensive. And if we've got a fairly large number of items that we're sorting, we're adding to our solution time, the time that we could be spending trying to find a solution, we are now spending sorting. Okay? So we have to weigh that off. This is getting to where you're starting to, I would hope, see some of the real interesting aspects of computing. Now, how does recursion work? I told you that we would talk a little bit about that, and we are. It's not, at least to understand it, it's not that complex. To implement it and go into all the details of how a compiler actually does it, it's a little complex, but to gain a good understanding of it is not that tough. Basically, here's what happens. When the compiler translates your functions, for every function that it translates, it creates what's called an activation record, or sometimes called an activation frame for the function. The activation frame for a function basically is just like a struct. It's like a record that holds information that the function needs to execute. What information does it need? Well, it needs storage for the return value of the function if the function is not void. It needs a pointer to the activation record of the calling function so that it can know who it was called from, also for access reasons. It needs to know the return memory address. It needs to know exactly where in that other function it was called from so that when it completes, the execution can return right to that point in that other function and continue execution. it also needs to keep around, it needs to have storage for the parameters, for all of the parameters. Even if they're passed by reference, it has to be able to store the address of where it's at. If it's passed by value, it needs to have storage for the copy, right? And it also has to have storage for any of the local variables that are declared inside of the function for temporary computation, whatever. So, for every function, a compiler creates an activation record template, as it's sometimes called, for your functions. And whenever your program is executing, when you make a function call, what happens is the compiler includes code in your executable so that whenever you make a function call, it searches its list, it keeps around a list of the activation records for all of the functions. And it searches that list to find the activation record for that function you're calling. It can do that pretty quick using some intelligent methods. It searches that out, and then it makes a copy of that activation record. It makes a copy of it. It then looks at the actual parameters. It looks at the function prototype, and it's actually already done this, and it's included code to fill in those elements of the activation record, to fill all this information in, like the parameters, whether to copy the values, whether to stick in an address to the actual parameter, whether to have a return value for the function, where it's at in memory at the moment, that address is taken up and that gets stuck into the activation record. And then it takes this activation record and it pushes it onto what's called the runtime stack. It pushes it onto the runtime stack. And then it jumps to the beginning instruction for that function and it starts executing it. And the function gets its values from the top record of the activation record stack, which is the copy that was created for its execution. Now, to start off with, this runtime stack contains actually an activation record for main. This is sort of what drives the entire execution of your program, because as functions get called, their activation records get stacked up here on this stack. As they finish execution, they get popped off, and then others get stacked on, and this stack grows and shrinks as you make function calls and return from them. And eventually, when you return from main, the stack's empty, the program's done. Now, for our knapsack problem, we would need to have here's an example, a snapshot of the runtime stack for the knapsack problem. To start off with, we have parameter storage. So we had our array. This would be a pointer to the array. This would be the total, start and end, the return address. I'm going to just set that to whatever Greek letter that is, which I can't think of at the moment. Say, die? All right. I'll take your word for it. I used to know the entire Greek alphabet when I was a math major. Part of the Greek alphabet has left me now. I had a friend who once went to Greece. He said his math education served him well because he could at least read the road signs. This would actually be a hardware, a memory address, and it would actually be back into the main program or wherever function this call made the initial call. And then what we would do is we would start the execution of that function, and it makes, of course, another recursive call. It reduces that total by a rate of, that should be a 1 there. That's wrong. That should be a 1. That should be a 1. Um, It reduces it by rates of start, and it makes another recursive call. So a new activation record gets created. The parameters get copied over. That's the power of recursion. Recursion basically, by making local copies of those pass by value parameters, it's doing a lot of sort of record keeping for you when you are trying to solve a problem. Because it keeps track of all those intermediate values and appropriately either discards them or uses them during each call. That, of course, makes another recursive call, reducing it by rate sub 1, which reduces it to 30. That makes another recursive call, reducing it by rate sub 2, which is negative 10. Now, that, of course, this would then get popped off. This would then get popped off returning false. It returns back to alpha. I labeled alpha. Alpha was the first recursive call address. I just said let the second one be at beta. And this is the way it would execute. As more functions, as more activation records would get stacked up, and then when it would be backtracking, they would get popped off, and then others would get stacked on.
I was looking at this, and is there any way to actually know what the indexes of the elements in the line were? Because basically, I would
Good question. Good question. Her question was, Her question was basically, hey, you've simplified the original problem that you started out with so much that you really aren't returning a lot of useful information, am I? All I'm returning is, okay, here's 100 items, and yes, there is some subset that sums up to your total. Okay, I'm out of here. And your user's going, wait a minute. I'd like to know a little bit more. How would I now, and see, that's why I was telling you though, once you've got your simple, once you've solved it simply, for the simple version, then you can go back in and add parts back in. So let's think about a simple addition. How about if I wanted to output to the user the index, let's make it simple here, the index of the items that would be in the solution. How would I do that?
The only thing that I can think of is make up an array of the size which is equal to right and save. And that's really long. And
yeah, and tedious and boring, as you could tell.
Yes. Or you could do a linked list.
A linked list? No, you're overkilling. There's simpler ways of doing it. No, I don't need another array. I don't need another list. Huh? Before I return true here, since I know this one is in the solution, can't I just say print out that index, print out start? I can say cout element at index q start is in the solution. Now, think about it. This was true, so when this one went back, it would print out index what? 4. This one would return true, and it would print out index 3. This one would return true, it would print out index nothing. No, because it's returning from here where it was false. Wait a minute. I missed one there. Yeah, it would also not print out 3 either. It would. This one, since it's returning to this first call, it would print out 4. This one's returning to the second call, it wouldn't print out 3. This one's returning to the second call, so it would not print out 2. These two are returning to the first for the first calls, so they would print out 0, 1, and 4, and I'd have my solution. Okay? Wait just a minute here. I want to make sure that I'm just about done with this section of the notes. I think I am. One more thing. One more. Give me just a couple minutes. I'll let you go early next time. I want to finish up this last slide here, 9.21 on recursion. Something you need to be aware of. Here is the C++ typical program memory model that most compilers use as a paradigm when they are creating the memory space in your code. They basically, first up here at the top, is some system privileges for the operating system that they won't let you get access to, unless you're really sneaky. And I'm not going to tell you how to do that. For one thing, it differs from operating this operating system. For two, I don't know. I used to know how to do it for one or two operating systems, which are no longer in existence. I don't know how to do it anymore, and it's the way you break the security of an operating system. But you can work on that. Next comes your binary code. Okay, this is sometimes referred to as the data segment. This is your executable code that goes in here. After that comes your static data, sometimes called the data segment. That's the data that gets allocated as your program starts to execute. It gets allocated statically at time of compilation, at time of execution, actually. And then following that are two other things. There's what's called the runtime stack and the heap. Now, the runtime stack is where the activation records are created. And they get stacked on top of here. And this thing grows and shrinks as functions call and finish executing. Down here at the highest memory address is the heap. This is basically your available memory that the program uses. When you call new, it allocates it from here. And when you call delete, it returns it to here. Now, as you might imagine, there is an obvious possible problem with this type of organization, and that's what? What happens if one of these gets too big? Your runtime stack can overflow. If your runtime stack overflows, most of the time that tells you that you've probably got a recursive function that's not finishing execution. Okay? It's not finishing execution and it's just overflowed the runtime stack. It's stacked up thousands of activation records and it's ran out of memory. If you request too much dynamic memory, then you could have a heap overflow. Now there are usually compilers will have special compiler instructions, pragma instructions, etc., that you can embed in the compiler to change the default size for these things. And they will let you sort of tell it to use more memory for the heap or more memory for the stack, whatever, appropriately. That doesn't necessarily solve all of your problems. And you've got to be writing some very large programs using a lot of memory or with a lot of function calls in order to really even concern yourself with this. For most of the program that you're going to be doing for the next couple years, unless you go out and take a job as an intern and start working for a company where you're working on a large program with a lot of other programmers, this isn't going to be a concern to you for the programming you do in your classes. They'll talk about this from time to time in some of your other various classes, but for the most part, it's not going to be a problem. Okay. Have a good weekend.